This is KZFR 90.1 FM, Chico, California, community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And you're listening to Ecotopia, where we'll be talking with Dan Galpern. He's the General Counsel of the Climate and Restoration Initiative, which is suing the EPA.
This is KZFR 90.1 Chico, and you are listening to Ecotopia, a weekly program exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. I'm Susan Chudy.
And I'm Stephen Chudy. We're playing music these weeks of catastrophe. Our guest on Ecotopia today, Dan Galpern, is trying to stave off climate disaster. He's the General Counsel, Executive Director of the Climate Protection and Restoration Initiative.
Dan Galpern will be in Chico Monday, March 27th from 7 to 8:30 at the South Chico Community Assistance Center. The event is free and open to the public, and he'll be talking about the lawsuit that he'll also talk about on this program tonight to get the federal court to require the EPA to phase out greenhouse gas pollution.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Children's Choir of Chico, presenting Spring Vibes, an evening of jazz with pianist Shigemi Manatika, along with Aram Cowell on trumpet, Ethan Sweat on bass, and Jake Harkonnen on drums. Joining them will be selections performed by Children's Choir of Chico's own Bel Canto and Bella Voce ensembles at the Almendra Winery and Distillery on Sunday, April 2nd, 5 p.m. There'll also be a light dinner, a live and silent auction, and more. Tickets are at Eventbrite or Chico Children's Choir of Chico.org. And we're supported by the Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering organic and local produce, organic groceries, supplements, as well as hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, cold brew coffee, and more. The co-op accepts online orders for curbside pickup and is looking for co-op owners to serve on its board of directors. For details, visit Chico Natural Foods co-op/BOD. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main. We want to remind you that the opinions expressed on Ecotopia do not represent the opinions or necessarily the views of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. We'll take a short break and be back to talk with Dan Galpern. This is Ecotopia on KZFR. We will shortly have our guest Dan Galpern on the phone talking us. He's the Chief Law Attorney of Climate Protection and Restoration Initiative.
Yeah.
Hi, Dan. Do we have you on the phone?
Yes. Good to be with you.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. We're pleased to introduce Dan Galpern. He's the General Counsel and Executive Director of the Climate Protection and Restoration Initiative. We read from their website, Climate Protection and Restoration Initiative is a 501c3. It's a nonprofit, public interest, science-based advocacy organization that's guided by scientists, legal scholars, and community and religious leaders who share our mission to protect and restore a viable climate system. Welcome, Dan Galpern.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Perhaps we could ask you first to talk a little bit about the organization. How long has it been around? How many people do you have working for you? We know you're the chief counsel. Give us a little background, and then we'll get into your initiative.
Sure. It's small still. Myself, and we have a professional communications specialist, and then we have volunteers, including a volunteer board of directors comprised of a number of eminent scientists and legal scholars, as you indicated. And we also have an international board of advisors. Mm-hmm. And I founded the organization only a couple of years ago. I have been representing the renowned climate scientist James Hansen and mm-hmm. working with him for the last 14 years and continuing. And I realized that it was really necessary to do something more to amplify the effectiveness of the work in which we had been engaged. And that led me to founding Climate Protection and Restoration Initiative.
So what are the objectives of the organization? I like your objectives.
The main objective is to figure out, Susan, how can we break the political impasse in this country that has impaired this nation's ability to do much more than talk a good game mm-hmm. on climate. And that political stalemate continues, of course, notwithstanding the fact that the Biden administration was able to get the inflation and the Democrats, with no Republican support, were able to pass the Inflation Reduction Act mm-hmm. Just this last year, which has some important, significant provisions, but is nowhere near what is needed for the United States to have a reasonably effective response to our climate crisis. So in any event, the objective that we began with remains. How can we do more under existing law, given the fact that there's not likely to be any significant new law to address the climate crisis?
We noticed yesterday that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change came out with its big synthesis assessment report on the dangers of continued climate change and the need for serious action to limit greenhouse gases. Is your diagnosis and prescription supported by the IPCC?
It certainly is. This is the major collection of relevant scientists in this area with respect to climate change and global warming and ocean acidification and all the entire panoply of impacts that result from our over-reliance on fossil fuels predominantly and our misuse of public lands secondarily, not only in this country, of course, but throughout the industrialized world. And the IPCC continues it's an increasingly stark warning that we have reached and gone well beyond, in fact, the safe mm-hmm. level of atmospheric CO2 and the other Kyoto 6 greenhouse gases, and so including, for example, methane, and that we need to dial back as rapidly as possible if we hope to protect and, in fact, restore a viable climate system. And that, in fact, is our mission as well.
Right.
And so the synthesis report, what came out yesterday was the summary for policymakers, and it's reasonably accessible. We're going to have a short review and a blog piece that I'm going to be posting at our website, which, if it's okay, I could plug. It's at
absolutely yes.
Yeah.
Say again.
The name of the organization is Climate Protection and Restoration Initiative, and the name of the website is the initials of the first three words, CPR, because we're in an emergency, like CPR, CPRClimate.org. And at CPRClimate.org, we have a great deal of materials, including with respect to the petition and the lawsuit that we're going to be talking about. But yes, we also have some a lot of other information about the climate crisis more generally. And it's important to understand that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is comprised of the leading scientists from the major institutions, including in the United States, where you have scientists working who are investigating this overwhelming problem. And they include, for example, in the United States, the Environmental Protection Agency, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and others. And this these reports from the IPCC are consensus reports, and this is the synthesis of the consensus reports that were issued over the last couple of years, including mm-hmm. Their report on the physical science basis for of climate change, and also their report on what is needed to adapt to and respond, including to mitigate the climate change crisis.
And the IPCC is still aiming for an overall climate increase of 1.5 degrees centigrade. Is that correct? The one that was agreed upon in Paris.
That's right. In 2015, and it was not so much the IPCC, but rather the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, mm-hmm. Which provides, I would say, overall direction to the IPCC, established a international goal to ensure against reaching the 2 degrees Celsius mm-hmm. Limit. And for and all nations further committed to working to ensure against more than 1.5 degrees Celsius mm-hmm. Warming over the pre-industrial level. We're on track to blow both of those limits, and the IPCC warns that we are already at this stage of warming and additional committed warming well into the danger zone, where we see substantial disruption to human and natural systems alike, including accelerating sea level rise, climate-induced wildfire in many regions of the country, including in the American West, and the beginnings of breakdown of important features of our agricultural system, and even threats to the food chain arising from ocean acidification and deoxygenation of many of our coastal waters. So we are not yet on track to recover. We need to do a lot more mm-hmm. than we have done to date to address this problem.
So a major effort of your organization and some others, whom we'll learn about, was a petition to the EPA. And the EPA is signed on to the, is part of the intergovernmental panel, as I understand. So you had a petition to the EPA to phase out greenhouse gas pollution. Describe what the petition asked for.
I should say the EPA is part of the U.S. government, and the U.S. government is a signatory to the Paris Agreement and is a part of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Right.
About 189 different nations are signatories to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change and also the Paris Agreement. And they commission the work and rely on the work of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So as I was describing, all of the risks and harms resulting from climate change, it's probable that at least some of your listeners are wondering or thinking to themselves that there ought to be a law. You know, there ought to be a law to prevent what is happening, to prevent the deterioration of prospects for our nation's future and for our children's future. Because it is, after all, our children and future generations who will suffer the most. We've only begun to have a taste of what's yet to come if greenhouse gas concentrations remain high and the global temperature keeps on rising and the oceans continue to acidify and lose oxygen. And so, in fact, there is such a law in the United States that is really fit for the purpose, if only the authority that is conveyed through it were fully exercised by our nation's leading environmental agency, the Environmental Protection Agency. And that statute is the Toxic Substances Control Act, which passed Congress in 1976, and it was substantially amended and strengthened in 2016. And under the Toxic Substances Control Act, where the administrator determines that one or more chemical substances present an unreasonable risk of injury to health or the environment, well, then the agency is supposed to impose certain limits and requirements, even to the point of prohibition on those chemicals until that unreasonable risk is eliminated. This is a very powerful statute. And in addition to that requirement, the agency is authorized to impose limits to the point of prohibition on the methods or means of disposal of those chemicals. Well, you know, one can ask oneself, how do we to date dispose of carbon dioxide and methane resulting from the exploitation and processing and use and disposal of fossil fuels? Well, I mean, the answer is plain. To date, we've just let these gases into the air as if the atmosphere is a free and open sewer. And so this statute is the only one that I know of, and I believe that I've scoured all the relevant statutes in the United States with respect to environmental policy, is the only one that would allow the agency to get after both aspects of the problem, both to phase out continuing pollution and to compel the major polluters to remove or pay to remove a share of their so-called legacy pollution, emissions that have already occurred.
When was
that? So that's the heart of it, and then I can talk to you about the petition next, unless you wanted to ask anything.
I just wanted to ask, when was the Toxic Substances Control Act passed? What was the status of Congress in those days? I'm having a hard time imagining it passing in the current climate.
Yeah, right. Well, good point. It passed in 1976.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But I should say, in 40 years later, in 2016,
it was strengthened.
There were substantial amendments to strengthen it. So even though we've had a sharply divided Congress, as recently as 2016, there was a bipartisan effort mm-hmm. to strengthen mm-hmm. the Toxic Substances Control Act. In any event, that was done in 1976, and then it was strengthened in 2016. The petition, the citizens have the right to petition, and by the way, this is not only with respect to the Toxic Substances Control Act, but a number of our bedrock environmental laws allow citizens to petition for stronger rules. For example, under the Clean Air Act, citizens mm-hmm. have the right and states have the right to petition for stronger implementation of various statutes under the Clean Air Act or the Clean Water Act or the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act and so on.
So
under Section 21 of the TSCA, the Toxic Substance Control Act, citizens have the right to urge EPA to promulgate a rule to constrain or even prohibit certain chemicals that present an unreasonable risk. And so that's what we did.
Okay, right. So you asked them.
This year.
Okay, so what the petition does is ask them to create rules that will enact the efforts to do something about greenhouse gases and other pollution from gases, methane.
Well, specifically, it asks EPA to commence a rulemaking, basically a process to lead to a strong rule.
Okay.
To control and limit and phase out, in fact, greenhouse gas pollution from fossil fuel utilization. Yes.
And so, of course, they want to do that, right?
Well,
okay.
The agency rejected our petition. They said they certainly sympathize with our goals, and the agency. Now, I should say, if your listeners wish to actually read our petition, they can go to our website cprclimate.org. It's all there. And the second part of it's in two parts. Part one is 25 pages or so of the law. And part two is a distillation of the relevant science. And in their letter of denial, EPA said, well, in fact, what petitioners wrote in their petition is a distillation of the type of information on which we, that is EPA, relied in 2009 when we did our endangerment finding leading to the control of greenhouse gases from tailpipes, you know, from auto and light truck tailpipes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they further said that that greenhouse gases are substances that are subject to the control of the Toxic Substances Control Act. So that it could be. Nonetheless, they denied the petition by saying that a rulemaking was unnecessary, that we're doing enough already.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so their claim is we're working on it.
Well, yes, that's right. Their claim is we're working on it under various other statutes, and also in terms of implementing the Inflation Reduction Act, which I talked about a little earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And you would expect then that they would have sought to establish in that letter. How are they going to get they said they're doing enough to meet the president's goals. And so you would have expected them to show how they were doing enough, and they will be doing enough to meet the president's goals. You would have expected them to say, well, you know, we're getting this amount of emissions reductions
evidence.
From the IRA, and this amount of emissions reductions from maybe future tailpipe emissions control and that sort of thing, and to provide a spreadsheet or something. But they didn't provide any of that.
Right. No evidence.
They did note that the IRA was supposed to lead to some significant reductions, namely an increase of about 15% of the reductions, the reduction pathway that we're already on. But they didn't do anything to show that it was going to add up to what the president's goal is for 2050, mm-hmm. namely to get to net zero before 2050, so that on net, the United States is no longer emitting greenhouse gas emissions. But they did not do that.
So were you surprised by their response? Did you expect something a little bit more substantive?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I was surprised, and yes, I did expect something more substantive.
It also, it seems to me, if they'd accepted the petition, it gave them license and plenty to do for the next 35 years. That is to say, even if you're interested in job security, accepting the petition would keep a lot of people employed doing very important and good work.
Well, that's true, Stephen, but even more than that, I think it would have invoked the authority of this important statute for them to actually do the work that many, many of them, I think, wish to do. Have a real significant federal, United States response to the climate crisis, so that we would be, in fact, rather than in name only, in the international community. You know, after all, our nation, regrettably, is responsible for more greenhouse gas emissions than any other nation. And that's important because, especially when you consider the long-lived nature in the atmosphere of CO2, right, which once released from factories or tailpipes or industrial processes, stays in the atmosphere not for weeks or months or years, but for millennia.
Yeah.
A substantial share remains essentially forever unless we can accelerate its drawdown into Earth's system. And we don't have many, many millennia to wait for Earth to be able to reincorporate what it took the planet millions of years to put into the ground through, the development of fossilization and sequestration through geologic time. And so we've already overshot the safe level of atmospheric CO2, and EPA knows that. How do they know it? Well, because the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has reported on this for the last decade. This, I think, is authority that this government needs, already retains, but needs to utilize in order to do what's needed.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and we're talking with Dan Galpern. He's the founder and director of the Climate Protection and Restoration Initiative. And your next step was a lawsuit. How is a lawsuit different from a petition? Who are you calling on, and what are you asking for or demanding?
We're demanding the same thing, namely that the EPA commence the rulemaking. But under Section 21, which is the citizens' suit provision and the citizens' petition section of the statute, and I should really emphasize this, that here we are, we're citizens supported by several hundred other, individual supporters. We certainly could use more support, more engagement, but the very section of the statute that allows citizens to petition also says that where the agency denies a petition, then the petitioners have the right to go to court and to ask the court to make the fundamental determination that I talked about before. Mm-hmm. That is to say, are the chemical substances that were at issue in the petition, do they present an unreasonable risk of injury to health or the environment, or do they not? And if they do, if the court then finds that the chemical substance presents an unreasonable risk, then the law specifies what the court is supposed to do, and namely, the court is supposed to order the EPA to commence the rulemaking that the petitioners sought in their petition. So this is the way that Congress understood that sometimes the EPA may not utilize the statute directly on its own and gives citizens the opportunity then to go to court to force the agency to do the right thing and commence the rulemaking that we sought.
Right. And I just want to step back a little bit because the plaintiffs in both the petition and the lawsuit are a pretty impressive group of people. You've already mentioned one, but could you tell us about the plaintiffs and kind of their knowledge and sway in the world?
You bet. Okay. So the plaintiffs include the climate scientist, James Hansen, who I've been who I explained before, I've been working with for the last 14 or more years. He's probably the most renowned climate scientist in the world. It was his testimony to Congress in the late 1980s when he was at the National, when he was at NASA, and he was head of the Goddard Institute of Space Studies at NASA, that brought the problem of global warming and climate change to the attention of the world. And so he is a petitioner, and as Susan said, he's also one of the plaintiffs now in this case. They also include Don Viviani. Don Viviani is a 35-year veteran EPA scientist, and during the course of his time at EPA, he was also head of its climate change policy evaluation unit. He is also, by the way, president of the board of Climate Protection and Restoration Initiative. They also include John Birx. John Birx is an emeritus professor of atmospheric chemistry at the University of Colorado. And, I mean, I think probably you two are a bit young to or have remembered this, but do you, by any chance, to remember the theory of nuclear winter that could ensue following a nuclear exchange between the United States and the then Soviet Union. Well, John Birx, along with a colleague from Germany, did the scientific work and published published about this for the first time ever in the Swedish journal, environmental journal, AMBIO. So he has done a great deal of service to the world already with respect to that, and he also did a number of the initial calculations and assessments about impacts from chlorofluorocarbon, CFCs, on the ozone layer, which eventually led to a very important efforts to ban chlorofluorocarbons for their so as to preserve the Earth's ozone layer. Richard Heaty is one of our petitioners, and again, also now one of our plaintiffs. And he's probably the foremost climate accountability analyst in the United States, if not the world. He's the head of the Climate Accountability Institute. And if you've ever heard of the term carbon majors, that derives from his work, where he assessed where are all the who has produced the fossil fuels, and he shows that only roughly 90 entities, including a number of well-known U.S. corporations like Exxon and Chevron and ConocoPhillips, and a number of other international companies around the world, and also nations, are the major producers, and so they're the ones who are by far the largest beneficiaries, as I said before, of the ability to continue to produce and utilize these fossil fuels in an unconstrained manner. So very important that he is with us. And also Lisa Van Susteren. Lisa Van Susteren is a practicing psychiatrist. She's an author and a specialist in the area of the psychological impact on young people of their knowledge that their future is increasingly blighted by the mounting catastrophe of climate change. And so those are our five individual petitioners. They also include the organization Climate Science Awareness and Solutions. This is Dr. Hansen's organization, and Dr. Hansen runs a program at Columbia University's Earth Institute in Climate Science Awareness and Solutions, and also he runs a nonprofit with the same name. And CPR Initiative, Climate Protection and Restoration Initiative, my organization. So we have two organizational plaintiffs and now petitioners and five experts in individual citizen petitioners.
And so how will this lawsuit proceed? What court does it go to? How do the are the arguments presented? Do the plaintiffs get to speak as experts to support the case? How is this going to happen?
Well, those are really good questions, Susan. So, first of all, we filed the lawsuit in the federal district court in Eugene, Oregon. The reason is that Climate Protection and Restoration Initiative's headquarters is here in Eugene, Oregon. Okay, so how will it proceed? Well, the law interestingly lays out the standard that needs to be applied, or at least how to proceed. So the law says that the court will decide the operative question whether the chemicals present an unreasonable risk de novo, which means anew, which means it should consider the question without respect to any determination that EPA made. Now, of course, EPA chose. EPA punted on the question. EPA never determined that these chemical substances don't present an unreasonable risk. They just said, we don't need to do that because it's unnecessary. But the court, I think, could take that into account. But the court is supposed to render that determination given all the relevant circumstances. And what that means then, Susan and Stephen, is that the record should be established before the court. And so there should be a full hearing, I think, on this operative question. Do greenhouse gases present an unreasonable risk to human health and the environment, or do they not? Now, as for your third question, will the plaintiff, the individual plaintiffs, get to testify? That's up to the court, but I think the answer is yes. Given that they are, each of them, experts in some regard on with respect to important aspects of the question, they could also qualify as experts. But I should say as well that we intend to have other experts to testify on various aspects of the problem. Well, we could talk about, aspects of, what goes into a reasonable unreasonableness determination, if you wish.
You have the full complaint on your website, and I was interested in what's included there. There's a lot of personal information, some plaintiffs saying the things that they can't do anymore because of the impact of greenhouse gases, the limitations in their playing outdoors and being able to use the ocean. Is this kind of typical in a lawsuit? I thought it was so interesting.
It is increasingly necessary in the area of environmental lawsuits because the courts, led by the Supreme Court, have fashioned various rules on standing. That is to say, it's the plaintiff's burden often to establish that the court has jurisdiction, has the power to hear a case, and the Supreme Court has said the only types of cases that federal courts can hear are where there are real cases and controversies. And so The court has established that that plaintiffs need to establish that they have actual injuries that would be addressed by the lawsuit in some effective way. Mm-hmm. And so that's why there's this unusual, what you would think is the usual amount of personal information in order to establish, for example, that Don Viviani, you know, is impaired in his open ocean swimming by the proliferation of jellyfish,
right?
Some of which are stinging,
and
also he's impaired by in his love for walking on the beach with his family members, including his granddaughter, for fear of stepping on stinging jellyfish and that sort of thing. Or Lisa Van Susteren, for example, she is affected by the fact that her patients, many young patients, are increasingly despair about their future. And she is unable to date to be able to truthfully tell them, it's okay, the adults have this. We're on top of this. And John Burks, for example, lives in Boulder, Colorado. You may recall that that just a couple years ago, a climate-induced drought had desiccated the vegetation to the west of Boulder. And when there was a small fire and prevailing westerly winds, there was a firestorm that went through significant parts of his city and also threatened some of his land nearby. So, yeah, these plaintiffs, at least several of them, have some specific injuries or have confronted some of the these severe risks and are able to articulate them as necessary.
Listeners, we're talking with Dan Galpern. He's the founder and director of the Climate Protection and Restoration Initiative that has filed a lawsuit against the EPA that would, in effect, compel them to take stronger action to end greenhouse gas emissions. Dan, could you tell us a little bit, what steps would the EPA have to take, assuming the lawsuit is successful?
Certainly. And by the way, for listeners who become intensely interested, I should say that I will be giving a talk in Chico.
Yeah, we have that on our list. Go ahead.
Next Monday, and I can talk more about that. But could you rephrase your question again, Stephen?
Yes. What would EPA have to do? I know you're concerned about, for example, a carbon tax. They would have to likely have to impose that. What other steps would they have to take? You mentioned earlier, and it stuck in my mind, that they have great rulemaking. I'm just going to guess theoretically they could outlaw fossil fuel emissions completely. It would be under their power under the current laws. So they would obviously not take extreme steps, but what would they do?
Definitely. Well, first let me just say something that I stressed, that we stressed both in the petition and the complaint, that the law requires EPA to act reasonably, including to phase in any such phase-out greenhouse gas pollution, and to do so in a way that would not unduly disrupt our economy or national security. So all of those protections are built in, and we emphasize those protections. So within those constraints, the EPA is free to do what is needed, and that would be fashioned during the course of the rulemaking, so that they would, you know, need to be looking at a range of options and ideas, some of which should, in our view, come from the public. And so we urged EPA in the course of its rulemaking to really get out to the public, not only to garner the best expert advice that it could, but also to meet with especially highly impacted communities at the front lines, next to, for example, refineries, communities that are threatened by sea level rise, communities that are threatened by the conventional pollution from industrial activities that consume a great deal of fossil fuels, communities, you know, next to coal mining operations or downwind of oil exploitation, that sort of thing. In any event, under the law, EPA needs to impose one or more of seven different requirements until the point that the unreasonable risk is eliminated. And as you stated, Stephen, they can include even restriction to the point of prohibition of the chemical substances at issue here that are being emitted into the atmosphere. But also under a corollary law, another statute, the 1952 Independent Appropriations Act, the agency also could impose a rising carbon fee on oil, gas, and coal. So it has substantial authority either directly under TSCA or under other statutes that Section 9 of TSCA sits, and when I say TSCA, I mean the Toxic Substance Control Act. And the statute says that it should utilize other authorities to the extent that those are adequate to control the problem that's complained of in the petition. And where they are not adequate, then the direct authorities under the Toxic Substance Control Act come into play. So yes, you're right. There's substantial authority, even to the point of prohibiting the manufacturer. By the way, manufacturer under the statute includes both production and importation. They can control the production and importation and processing and distribution and commerce and use, that is utilization, burning of fossil fuels, and disposal of their waste products, namely CO2 and methane and the rest. This is all specified in the statute.
So what's your level of optimism that you'll get a favorable ruling in court, and when do you anticipate this case going forward?
Well, we filed the case, and the agency has already indicated that it is going to respond by attempting to get it dismissed outright. They will be filing this motion to dismiss probably on April 10th. And then we will oppose that motion. And they're planning to oppose it on a number of grounds, and we think that we can defeat all of those.
Yeah.
We expect also to be having to confront industry, because industry may well be on the side of the agency. And so, you know, this is another reason why we're going to the public and trying to seek additional support so that we can gear up as necessary to meet every one of these challenges.
So tell
it could take a number of months before we get to the actual hearing. The actual timing, Susan, is controlled by the court, and is a function of how quickly we can dispense with the motion to dismiss, and then we will be taking discovery to discern how the EPA came to its conclusion to date. There will be expert testimony in both ways. So I can't really tell you, because we don't have a set schedule for how this will proceed after the motion to dismiss is dealt with. But it could well be a number of months or longer.
So how can people support you? How can they support the CPR initiative? What can we do in our communities to have an impact on this?
Thank you. Well, actually, there's two sets of things. The first is that people can still go to our website and endorse and sponsor our petition. After all, our petition is the organization's major statement as to what we think needs to be done in order by the United States in order to address the climate crisis under existing law. And so at CPR, climate.org.
Okay.
One can go to our petition page, and at the bottom of it, people can endorse and sponsor if people are interested to make a financial contribution. But you don't need to make a financial contribution in order to endorse. People can endorse and get on our list and, you know, and be displayed. We've displayed not only high-level endorsers, but all endorsers.
Nice.
I mean, at least through our directory of endorsers so that you can see. And we have now over 1,000, actually.
Great.
Endorsers and a number of sponsors, thankfully. That's how we're able to, you know, be moving ahead and prosecuting this. So that's one way. The second way, and this is ambitious, but I might as well tell you since you asked.
Absolutely.
Well, like I said before, had EPA made the right decision and accepted our petition, then that would have commenced the rulemaking process. And as I indicated before, we stressed that the agency, in order to do a proper rulemaking on something this momentous, really needs to get out to the country. And so we urged them to do hearings all over the country, and at least several in the West and several up and down the Eastern Seaboard and also through the continental United States. Well, in any event, as I indicated, they rejected the petition. They did not accept it. And so, of course, they're not doing that. So we have determined that to the extent that we have resources, we will try to do some of that. And so, in fact, we did hold our first public hearing, and that hearing focused on the central question that was raised in their letter of denial, we think, and that is, what more should the United States be doing to effectively address the climate crisis? And in fact, if people are interested, the entire hearing is on our website. You go to our website and there's a drop-down menu and there's one item under videos called Public Hearings Archives. And if people are interested, they can go listen to that entire 6 hours of hearing. By the way, I should say, we did invite the agency, EPA, to attend, but they didn't show. And so, you know, this goes to the question, well, what more could be done? If the community of Chico sought to really engage, we could even have a public hearing in Chico so that persons with expertise or considered views could also provide them to us. And again, we would provide the record of that to the agency. So in any event, these are two central ways that we urge people to do. And at a minimum, we are hoping that listeners will go to our website and both endorse and hopefully sponsor our petition.
And just to get this in, we only have a minute left. Dan will be here. Dan Galburn is the founder and director of the Climate Protection and Restoration Initiative. And he will be here on Monday, March 27th. That's this coming Monday from 7 to 8:30. He'll be at the South Chico Community Assistance Center. That's on 1805 Park Avenue here in Chico. And it's free and open to the public. So you can hear more about this and more that we as Chicoans can do to support this work. Thank you so much, Dan. We really appreciate it.
I just have to throw in quickly.
Steve has to throw something
people
in.
Would not forgive me if I didn't mention that you were the director of the Chico Peace and Justice Center in the 1980s, and we're still
That's
grateful
right.
for that.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, it's been an honor to be with you. Thank you for the opportunity, and I hope to see you and friends when I'm giving a talk on Monday the 27th there in Chico.
Mm-hmm. Sounds great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a minute is Bobby...
Tryon,
but what's the name of the show?
It's got a new name. It's North State Local Voices, and she'll be talking with Paul Peck of the Chico Rotary Club. And Rotary Club has been a major sponsor of numerous projects in our community.
So stay tuned for that, and following that will be Ginger Nichols with more music. So stay tuned to KZFR all night long.
Slow.